Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from AntiWar.com, and this is Anti-War News for Tuesday, October 4th, 2022. The first story at the top of AntiWar.com today, Ukraine offers the U.S. targeting control. So this is from Kyle Anzalone and Connor Freeman at the Libertarian Institute. And the Ukrainian government is prepared to give the Biden administration virtual control over its selection of Russian targets in a bid to receive longer range weapons from the U.S. And this is according to a report from CNN. So the idea here is that Ukraine would provide the U.S. with a full list of potential Russian targets, and it would give the U.S. veto power over the potential strikes. Now, what Ukraine's doing here is that they're seeking longer range missiles from the U.S. that the U.S. has been hesitant to give, specifically the Army tactical missile systems that have a range of about 190 miles. So far, the missiles that the U.S. has provided Ukraine that are being fired from these HIMARS rocket launch systems have a range of 50 miles. So 190 miles is a pretty significant upgrade. Now, the Biden administration has been hesitant to provide these weapons over concerns that they could be used to target Russian territory and that could lead to an escalation or provoke Russia. So that's what Ukraine is trying to alleviate those concerns by saying, hey, why don't you, you know, we'll show you what we're going to do and you could veto it if you want. So really what it would do is it would significantly increase, it seems like at least, increase U.S. involvement in Ukraine's war planning, because we know besides the weapons that the U.S. is providing Ukraine, the U.S. is also giving them intelligence support. And this would sort of increase, I think, what we would consider, you know, planning these operations and stuff. And the U.S. So far, they still haven't approved sending these weapons, that we haven't seen any indication that it's going to happen soon. But I mean, they've shown us throughout the war that they're willing to escalate support for Ukraine. Just, you know, eventually they get there. Eventually, they'll probably send these missiles, if I were to guess, especially if Ukraine's offering such close control over how they could be used. Okay, so the next one here. Ukrainian forces make gains in the southern Kherson region. So Russian installed officials in Kherson, which is the southern portion of Ukraine that Russia controls. It's just north of Crimea. They said on Monday that Ukrainian forces made some gains in the area. So if you're watching on the video, I have a map in here from South Front, and it shows this little area here where Ukraine pushed into Russian-controlled territory. It's on the west bank of the Dnieper River. There's also an area here where Russian forces repelled a Ukrainian offensive. And this comes, I mean, so this comes, Ukraine launched its Kherson counteroffensive at the end of August, and they've been suffering very heavy casualties. And this appears to be their most significant gains in this region since then. And Ukraine also made gains in the eastern region, and it came after over the weekend they took the city of Lyman in the Donetsk Oblast, and they have captured a few smaller villages since then, it looks like. And so these gains come as Russia is sending in reinforcements. And after Russia mobilized, Putin ordered the mobilization of 300,000 new Russian troops. So it seems like Russia is preparing to really reinforce its front line here. And Ukraine has made these gains. And from what I understand, the city of Lyman, I think it's pronounced, was not too heavily defended by Russia. They pulled out of there kind of quickly, and they said they didn't want to be encircled. But Ukraine is making gains, probably at a high cost, and it comes as Russia is working to annex this territory. But again, we're kind of expecting something pretty significant to come out from Russia. I'll get more into what I think their plans are in the next article. But yes, Ukraine is definitely making some gains here. The question is if they could hold on to them or how significant they are. I think when we talk about the Donbass, that's a much more significant region for Russia. They want to control that entire region. So the next one, Russia's State Duma approves annexation of Ukrainian territories. So on Monday, the State Duma, which is Russia's lower house of parliament, unanimously approved a measure to formalize the absorption of Russian-controlled territories of Ukraine. Russia is annexing areas that it controls in Kherson, Zaporizhia, and the breakaway Donbass republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. Putin signed off on the annexation on Friday, but both houses of Russia's parliament need to ratify the treaties that he signed. And Russia's Federation Council, which is the upper house of parliament, could approve the annexation plan as soon as Tuesday. Under the law that was passed by the State Duma, all the people living in the territories are recognized as Russian citizens as of September 30th. That was the day Putin signed off on the annexation. So what's not clear is where Russia is going to set its new border. Because Russia does not control all of the regions that it's annexing. You know, it doesn't fully control the oblasts that it's annexing. Russia currently controls the vast majority of Luhansk, but only a little more than half of Donetsk. But Putin and other Russian officials, they've made clear that they've said, when asked explicitly, that they're going to continue their military operation until at least they capture the rest of Donetsk. So that's their goal, and I think it's going to be their focus over the coming months as they're reinforcing in that area, that they're definitely going to try to finish capturing all of the Donbass. And as I've mentioned multiple times, you know, this annexation, it brings the war into a dangerous new phase, I think, because Russia is going to consider Ukrainian counteroffensives on these areas as attacks on Russian territory. And this comes after Putin said that Russia could use nuclear weapons to defend its territorial integrity, which, you know, that falls in line with Russia's doctrine, with their military doctrine. They've always said if the country faces an existential threat, they could use nuclear weapons. But it is significant because Russia is expanding now. And again, back to the first story, how intimately involved the U.S. is with not just sending weapons, but coordinating this war, intelligence, picking targets, things like that. At some point, we might see a response from Russia, a response aimed at NATO and the U.S. It's certainly possible, but the U.S. and NATO are not backing down. They don't want to change, and it's just escalation after escalation. The next one here, Ukraine tells the EU that delays in delivering billions in aid are not acceptable. So Ukraine kind of gave an earful to the European Union on Monday because they have delayed. There's been some delays in aid shipments. An advisor to Ukrainian President Zelensky said that these delays are not acceptable. So Ukraine and the EU, they signed a memorandum of understanding on Monday that the EU would provide Ukraine with 5 billion in euros in long-term loans. And the funds are part of 9 billion in euros that the EU promised Ukraine back in May. But so far, only 1 billion has been delivered. So this advisor to Zelensky said, quote, "Our Minister of Finance is under extreme high pressure. When he sends these checks to the military, to pension funds, we have to have this money in hand. So something like 1 week or several weeks delay is just not acceptable," end quote. So it's just something because, you know, Ukraine is totally reliant right now on the EU. Their government, at least, is reliant to keep functioning and running. You know, they're paying, the U.S. and its allies are paying to just run the Ukrainian government right now. And, you know, they just don't have any patience when it comes to potential delays, even as Europe is facing, is going to be facing an economic crisis of its own, it looks like, with these energy prices. So I just thought that was interesting how Ukraine just doesn't have any patience for something like that. All right, the next one here. So Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla and SpaceX, he created quite the controversy on Twitter on Monday when he tweeted out he floated an idea for a peace plan between Russia and Ukraine, and it had a few planks, which were to redo the elections of annexed regions under UN supervision. Russia will leave if that is the will of the people. So he's saying redo the referendums in Kherson, Zaporizhia, the Donbass, have the UN supervise it, and then Russia should leave or stay depending on the results. And then the next part, Crimea becomes formally part of Russia as it has been since 1783 until Khrushchev's mistake. I thought it was interesting that he said that. The water supply to Crimea would be assured. That was a big part of why Russia took parts of Kherson and Zaporizhia, because the water supply to Crimea was cut off by Ukraine. And Ukraine remains neutral. So he put out floated this idea for a peace plan, and he put up a poll to see if people supported it. And 61% said no, and 38% said yes. So this tweet really angered. I mean, if you look on Twitter, it's just like thousands of people just screaming at Musk for doing this. And whatever you think of him, you know, he said some interesting things. He said that he believes it's highly likely that this proposal, something like this, will eventually happen, will eventually be the result, and that it's just a question of how many will die before then. And he also noted that a possible outcome of the conflict is nuclear war. And these tweets, which I think are very reasonable, they drew just really unhinged and angry responses from Ukrainian officials, even though Musk, as the CEO of SpaceX, has supported Ukraine in its war pretty significantly by working with the U.S. government to supply Kiev with Starlink terminals. That's the satellite internet service that SpaceX provides. And this enables Ukrainian forces to access the internet from virtually any location. From my understanding, they're really using this technology for a lot of things on the battlefield. But it doesn't matter. You know, he can't have an opinion on the war. The most notable reply came from Andriy Melnyk, who is Ukraine's outgoing ambassador to Germany. He told Musk to F off. He said, quote, F off is my very diplomatic reply to you, end quote. And I am censoring that because I want to keep this show family friendly. But, you know, he said the F word there. And then he, in another tweet, he said, quote, the only outcome is that now no Ukrainian will ever buy your effing Tesla crap. So good luck to you, end quote. So Zelensky, he also, you know, piled on Musk by tweeting out a poll of its own, of his own, asking, which Elon Musk do you like more? And the two responses are one who supports Ukraine or one who supports Russia. So that's implying that just discussing a peace deal means that you support Russia. That's the attitude that they have. And these Ukrainian officials, you know, they want tens of billions of dollars in aid from the US and Europe and everything, but they just, any mild, it's not even criticism, it's just discussion of potential peace talks, kind of recognizing the reality of the situation. They can't handle that at all. They just have to jump on people like this. And there's just so many people following along. And I mean, lately Twitter, there's just so many people pro NATO, pro Ukrainian trolls. And, just in all my tweets, just all over the place, just, you know, calling people, all sorts of names and stuff for calling for peace, for saying that Ukraine is not worth risking nuclear war, not worth risking humanity. And that's just a very controversial position to these people, it seems like. Now I just need to mention that it's our fundraiser at antiwar.com. And it's very important. You know, we're entirely reader funded, and we need to ask our readers every year. We do fundraisers, sometimes every quarter, sometimes over longer periods of time. But right now we're asking for our readers and listeners to this show, because this is an antiwar.com podcast and YouTube show. You know, this wouldn't be possible without my employment at antiwar.com. And we need your support. We really need it. And I know things have been tough for everybody. Things have been tough for us too, but we're trying to raise $80,000 in our fundraiser. If you look at the page, you see we have raised a few thousand already. So hopefully, that momentum continues. But if you like what I do, if you want to support what I do, we need antiwar.com to keep going and be funded. And if you go to antiwar.com/donate, and you can see the different ways that you could support us. There's also a number there where you could call Angela Keaton, who she does a great job of doing all of our, a lot of our fundraising, and she's very available and personal. You could call her and discuss the site with her or ask her where your donation is going to go. And I mean, it goes directly to supporting us. So please donate and help out. Back to the news. So we left up the Nord Stream article that I went over that I wrote yesterday about where Blinken said that the Nord Stream sabotage is a tremendous opportunity, just because we didn't really see that anywhere else in the media, in the mainstream media. So I think it's important to keep that up. And we also put up an article from that came out back in 2004 from the Telegraph. And it's about a CIA plot that led to huge blasts in a Siberian gas pipeline. Sorry, these ads are popping up and making it hard for me to read. But basically, this article says that back in 1982, I believe, yes, 1982, the U.S. Sabotaged a Soviet pipeline, a gas pipeline, and it led to explosions. So, you know, there is a precedent. Again, we still don't know if the U.S. was behind the who was behind the Nord Stream attacks, but the U.S. certainly has the motive. Okay, the next one here, this is another one from the Libertarian Institute from Kyle and Connor. North Korea appears to have fired a missile over Japan. So Japan warned its citizens to take shelter as it estimated the flight path of a North Korean missile that went over its territory. Pyongyang has carried out a series of ballistic missile tests over the past week and recently. And this comes as the U.S. and South Korea have been carrying out joint war games. North Korea has stepped up its missile tests. Sorry, just blanked out there for a second. So it seems like the missile, according to these Japanese reports, went over northern Japanese territory, the northern islands. And this is the first time North Korea has apparently fired a missile over Japan since 2017. So it's just an example of how tensions are very high in that region. And Kamala Harris was just in South Korea. She traveled to the DMZ and she delivered some pretty harsh remarks against North Korea. The Biden administration has not really done anything to ease tensions between the two Koreas. You know, they maintain that their goal is a denuclearized Korean peninsula, but they're not offering, and that they say that they're open to talks, but they have to offer something to the North to facilitate talks, which would be sanctions relief. That's really the thing is, they have to offer something. Idea that was explored by the Trump administration would have been to give some sanctions relief in exchange for a pause of North Korea's nuclear program, as opposed to a denuclearization. That's something that I think could have a chance to succeed, but they haven't tried anything like that. All right. So the next one, Iran says that it's exchanging messages with the U.S. and says that a nuclear deal is possible, although I have my doubts. But this was from Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani. He said, quote, "There is still a possibility and a chance to resume the implementation of the nuclear deal. Efforts are underway with the European coordinator and other mediators, including the foreign ministries of neighboring countries, to exchange messages to reach an agreement," end quote. So nuclear deal talks, they appeared to be stalled, and an agreement seemed unlikely after the U.S. rejected Iran's latest response in the public negotiations. And that was back in September, at the beginning of September. But he's saying that a deal could still be salvaged if the U.S. has the political will. So he's just saying if the U.S. has the political will, they can conclude a deal in a short period. And his comments come after Iran released two detained Iranian Americans amid rumors of a potential prisoner swap. So what I discussed yesterday was that Iranian media said that they expect the U.S. to release $7 billion in frozen Iranian funds as part of this deal of releasing these prisoners. But the U.S. said that that wasn't true. A State Department spokesperson said that that wasn't part of the deal, which I suspected. But maybe they gave them a reason to believe that. I'm not sure. So Kanani, he also criticized the U.S. for imposing new sanctions on Iran amid negotiations, saying that it was not a constructive approach. And Biden signaled on Monday that the U.S. was going to add more sanctions. He said that the U.S. was going to impose further costs against Iran over its response to anti-government protests that have taken place in the country, signaling that even more sanctions are on the way. So the U.S. has expressed support for these protesters. And speaking of Elon Musk, you know, the U.S. said that they loosened some sanctions to allow Starlink to operate inside Iran. But the issue is that the government wouldn't want the people to get their hands on them. So it's not clear. You know, there's an article in the New York Times that said the U.S. was discussing ways to get it in and floated ideas like smuggling into the country. But it's not clear if that's really happening. But that would be the U.S., you know, providing material support to these protesters. But yeah, so just more with, I would be surprised if these talks really go anywhere. I'm just very skeptical that this nuclear deal will be revived and that the U.S. would lift sanctions on Iran. I think it would be great if they did, but Biden has just taken a very hard line on this issue. Okay, the last one, the U.S. bombed Somalia again. U.S. Africa Command said Monday that the U.S. launched an airstrike in Somalia on October 1st and said that the action killed a senior al-Shabaab leader. So AFRICOM did not name the target in its press release, but the U.S.-backed Mogadishu-based government said that Abdullah Nadir, who they described as a co-founder of al-Shabaab, was killed in an operation on the same day that the U.S. launched the strike. So AFRICOM claimed in its initial assessment that no civilians were killed or injured, but I always stress this when we discuss these strikes in Somalia because they barely get reported. Very few people are paying attention to them, and we cannot take the Pentagon at its word when it comes to civilian casualties, especially in Somalia. They're known for undercounting civilian casualties in this country, in this shadowy secret air war that they have. They said that the airstrike was launched near the town of Jalib, which is about 230 miles southwest of Mogadishu. The Somali government's information ministry said that Nadir was al-Shabaab's chief prosecutor, is how they described him, and said that he was in line to replace the group's leader, Ahmed Diri, who is currently sick, according to the Somali government. Now, there's been heavy fighting in Somalia between the U.S.-backed government and al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab launched a major attack on a local government building in the central Hiran region on Monday, killing 20 people and wounding 36 more. The Somali government has reported recent gains in central Somalia, and U.S. airstrikes in support of the government have become more frequent as this fighting has been happening. The last known U.S. airstrike took place in Somalia on September 18th in the Hiran region. AFRICOM said that bombing killed 27 al-Shabaab fighters, so that's a lot. And again, they said there was no civilian casualties, but we need verification of that. So the U.S. air war against al-Shabaab has escalated since Biden ordered up to 500 troops to deploy to Somalia back in May. So it's unfortunate because one of the very few bright spots of Biden's foreign policy when he first came in was that airstrikes in Somalia really declined under Trump. They shot up to record levels. He bombed Somalia more than any other president. But when Biden came in, they stopped for a little while. And then there was a few here and there. But now it's really escalated since he signed off on that deployment back in May. So it's just not you know, this is just a war. The U.S. is at war in Somalia, and it's just severely underreported. This was reported more than most U.S. airstrikes in Somalia because they said they killed a senior al-Shabaab leader. So that got a lot of attention. But just in general, you know, we just never hear about this war. But that's it for the news for today. We have a lot of good viewpoints, as always. Our picture story is old Liz Truss, the new British prime minister, who called herself a huge Zionist and huge supporter of Israel. So, yeah, she really likes Israel. But that's it for the show. Thank you for listening. Again, it's our fundraiser. We need your help. Antiwar.com/donate. And follow me on Twitter. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. I got to push that more. But I appreciate all the feedback I've been getting on the show. And I'll talk to you tomorrow with some more news. Thanks for listening.